Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Some may want to risk their lives. I think maybe more would like to risk other people's lives.
No, that's right. You know, if you want to risk your life, I would say go to Ukraine and volunteer to fight on behalf of the Ukrainians. And that
exactly.
would be a really worthwhile way to risk your life.
Welcome, one and all, to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join us today. My guest today is Francis Fukuyama, one of America's leading intellectuals, author of many books. He is also a senior fellow at the Olivier Nomellini Senior Fellow at Stanford University. His most recent book is Liberalism and Its Discontents. He is also the author of a really stimulating new piece about how populism happened, and we're going to get into that in some detail. But before we do, Frank, first of all, thank you so much for being here. And I want to begin with something you wrote. I think you said you wrote it in 1989. I'm talking about The End of History and the Last Man, because I recently reread it, and I have long felt that this was one of the most unjustly misunderstood, maligned books ever. I cannot count the number of times people have said, well, I guess Frank Fukuyama sure wishes he hadn't written that. So can you just outline, I'll tee up the first one. The first thing that drives me crazy is when people say that people who obviously didn't read the book, but just saw the title and thought that you were arguing somehow that history was actually over, that events would no longer happen. So that was the dumbest. So we can start there. But then there were other criticisms, and I would love for you to just take a few minutes to talk about that book and the reaction to it.
Sure, Mona. So thanks. I really appreciate being on your show. I'm a regular listener. I'm not going to be able to listen in the gym this week because I don't want to hear myself talking, but you know, that's okay. Yeah, I've been trying to explain this to people for the last 35 years. It gets a little bit frustrating. The idea of history is not just the succession of daily events. It's history with a capital H, which we might better label development or modernization, because, you know, I believe that there has been progress over the last 40,000 years of that there have been human beings on Earth as we progress from one different type of society to another. I think this is widely accepted by everyone. You know, the world we live in modern America is very different from, you know, the situation in Sudan or Guatemala or other less developed countries. And that represents historical evolution of social and political forms. So that's the meaning of history. The meaning of end is not the just stopping of events. It is really, where is this modernization process taking us? And the argument that I was trying to make was that for a good 150 years, Karl Marx and his followers believed that history would end or culminate in a communist utopia. Mm-hmm. And when I wrote the original article, The End of History, with a question mark at the end, I was simply saying, well, Marx may be right that there's history, there's progress, but it's not going to culminate in communism. It looks like it's going to culminate in the stage before you get to communism, which is bourgeois liberal democracy tied to a market economy. And, you know, I still believe that that is correct. And that was really what was intended by that particular title.
I think you also said at one point that you were drawing upon the work of Hegel, who talked about the end of history in the sense of its goal, the thing toward which it was going, not in the sense of an end to a play.
Yeah, well, the philosopher Hegel really created the whole philosophical school that said that there was such a thing as history and therefore progress. And Marx simply took Hegel's framework and said, no, no, it's not the liberal republic that is the termination point of this process. It's really communism. And, you know, people on the left believe that for many, many years. And I think...
And some still do.
Some still do. I think if you look at, Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, if that's, in fact, Hugo Chavez, when he was still alive, actually attacked me and said, no, no, the real end of history is Chavismo. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, we're really in trouble because Venezuela is a real mess right now.
It's a wreck. Yeah, I think as everybody knows. But and then some people accused you of triumphalism. They said, you know, you were sort of too ready to declare that liberal democracy as we practice it or as America practices it is the model for the whole world. But I actually thought on my reading of it, that you were actually quite prescient in worrying about some of the things then, and this is, 30 years ago that you wrote this, that we really are seeing play out. And one of the things that you said in that book was that, you know, when people are mostly satisfied with the material conditions of their lives, as liberal democracy and free markets deliver, that they may feel like they're missing out on the drama of life, on sacrifice, on conflict, on those things that really get the blood up. And you were speculating in the book that that is a vulnerability of liberal democracy that we're not sure how that might play out in the future. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Oh, no, I'm very glad you noted that. The full title of the book was The End of History and the Last Man. The Last Man was really the last five chapters of the book that talked about this phrase of Nietzsche's, who criticized the end of history, saying that if you have a system that produces peace and prosperity, people are not going to have anything to strive for, and human beings want to be something higher than you know, just peace and prosperity. They want to be able to struggle, and if you can't struggle for democracy, you're going to struggle against democracy. And I think that that's exactly what we're saying. I'm publishing next year a memoir, the title of which is In the Realm of the Last Man. And I actually think that that describes our current situation, especially on the right. I've been reading Laura Field's Furious Minds.
Me too. Yeah, yes, right here.
It's a terrific book about the right. And, you know, the right is Nietzschean in that sense. I mean, they want to be able to die for something because the current world is full of, you know, stability, prosperity. They're all middle class people making their way. Maybe there's a little inflation and there's, you know, too many immigrants and that sort of thing. But basically, the world is actually in pretty good shape. But that's not enough because they want a world of struggle. They want a world in which they can risk their lives for something. And there doesn't seem to be a whole lot that we can risk our lives for. And that's why I think they kind of invent, an existential crisis.
Exactly.
That, yeah.
Yeah. And some may want to risk their lives. I think maybe more would like to risk other people's lives.
No, that's right. You know, if you want to risk your life, I would say go to Ukraine and volunteer to fight on behalf of the Ukrainians. And that would be a really worthwhile way to risk your life. But, you know, showing up on Capitol Hill on January 6th, dressed in camouflage, fatigues, that's not, you know, that's just cosplay.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, now I want to turn to the piece that you wrote recently. It's The Internet, Stupid, is the title. And you pose the question, why now? Why did we have this upsurge in populism, not just in the United States, but in many countries around the world? And you come to the conclusion, it's in the title, you come to the conclusion it's the internet. But first, you tick through some of the other possible reasons that have been advanced since 2016. That was the year of Brexit, and it was the year of Trump's election. So that's a good starting point. I mean, there were other populists who were already in power at that point, but like Erdogan and others. But why don't we go through, as you did in the piece, why don't we go through possible causes one by one and have you explain why you rejected them?
Sure. Yeah, this is something that a lot of us have been thinking about for some time. And like many complex social phenomena, there are multiple causes for why we're in the situation we're in. But, you know, the question is, you know, are some of them more important than others in explaining? And I think a really good explanation has to answer a couple of specific questions. Why all of a sudden in the middle of the second decade of the 21st century does this stuff start to happen? And secondly, why does it take the particular form that it does, where people seem to be, you know, completely disconnected from the evident reality of, you know, of their actual situation?
Let me just interrupt to spell that out.
Okay.
Because you say they're not just not dealing with reality of their own situations. They're not dealing with reality in general. I mean, they are, they believe things that are clearly false. You know, the election of 2020 was stolen, vaccines cause autism, et cetera, right?
No, okay. That's right.
Yeah.
And I would say, in fact, that conspiracy theories have come to define what it means to be a conservative in America today. You know, it used to be the Reaganite agenda of low taxes, deregulation, individual freedom, this sort of thing. But yeah, it really is whether you believe, you know, in these weird theories that really partake of a completely different reality than, you know, than the mainstream. And so you need to explain both the, you know, why this occurs, you know, at the time it does, and why it takes this weird conspiratorial form. So the first explanation that everybody gave, and some people still give, is economic. Mm-hmm. You had this neoliberal period, globalization, there's a lot of inequality, a lot of people were left behind. So, you know, there's no question that that is the case. You have a lot of unemployed, you know, coal miners and steel workers and so forth that had been part of Trump's coalition. But, you know, I don't know what, more than 80 million people that voted for him, of that group, the vast majority were not out of work, you know, coal miners. They were people with perfectly comfortable, middle-class lives. And I would put it even more strongly. It's hard to imagine a historical period in which we have been doing better than we are right now. You know, we did go through COVID and the financial crisis, but at the end of that, there's low unemployment. We had a little bit of inflation under Biden, but, you know, we had like 20% inflation back in the 1970s, and it didn't lead to this kind of populist upsurge.
And we had much worse unemployment back in the 1970s, so much worse. And interest rates were sky high. I mean, there was like a trifecta in the 1970s.
And if you go back to the 1930s, the American unemployment rate was like 25%. So, and actually, one of the reasons I always thought that America was actually a pretty good society was that we went through that kind of crisis of the Great Depression without getting fascism out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are at a much more mild and actually much more hopeful period of economic, you know, prosperity. And yet we're getting these people that say things have never been worse. All right. So that's why I don't think economics is really adequate. The second explanation has to do with racism, misogyny, you know, nativism, all these bad things. We are certainly seeing a lot of that coming out, you know, Nick Fuentes is being mainstreamed, you know, on the right and so forth. So again, there's no question that this is part of it. But I think that it's hard to explain then why you had the number of African Americans and Hispanics voting in last year's election. Maybe it's going to be different, you know, going forward. But you had a lot of racial minorities voting for Donald Trump. And if, you know, they're really being driven by this deep, you know, these deep prejudices, why is that happening? I personally actually think that most people in the MAGA movement are not deeply racist. You know, they've accepted, you know, tolerance for people unlike themselves. There's a core of real racists out there, but that simply does not explain how Trump got over the top. Another explanation is, you know, charismatic leadership. So again, I don't doubt that Donald Trump has very specific qualities that other successors probably don't have, like J.D. Vance or Marco Rubio. I'd be very surprised if they can, you know, do rallies of the sort that he does. And so, you know, again, it's worthwhile explanation, but not anything like a total one. There's one that I think resonates particularly with people like you and me, who had been, you know, more on the conservative side, but, you know, really don't like Trump, which is dislike of what the Democrats are offering. And you have had, you know, I think these very unappealing forms of identity politics, defund the police, a kind of cultural mix that the Democrats have been offering that I think really offended a lot of people, because part of it was, you know, was actually, I just thought, nonsensical. I mean, you don't want to defund the police. You know, I think the whole transgender movement is very hard to explain in terms of, you know, the underlying issues, and also, you know, so contrary in a certain way to what, you know, everybody experiences about, you know, sexual differences and so forth.
And also it was the way in which those issues were being controlled by the left. That's right. They didn't brook debate or argument. If you didn't see it their way, then they labeled you as a bigot. Yeah. And that was not a good or a healthy way to argue.
Yeah. On the other hand, I would say that probably 90% of Americans didn't actually experience that in their lives. You know,
that's,
I mean,
true.
It's something that really hit academics and people in elite institutions, you know, in the arts and so forth, Hollywood.
The chattering class.
Right. The chattering class. Yeah. So I don't think that was it. Another issue that I think actually is important going forward was the failure of mainstream parties to actually deliver concrete results. You know, I'm a big fan of the abundance movement because I think mm-hmm. that it is true that American government, especially in blue states, has not been able to build stuff in a way that it used to. You know, we built the Golden Gate Bridge and the Hoover Dam and the Tennessee Valley Authority in the space of 3 or 4 years in the early 30s. And we couldn't possibly do that today. You know, we've got high-speed rail that was promised to us here in California back in the 1990s. And they built a little segment, you know, out near Fresno. But, you know, it's not going to be in my lifetime. I
heard somebody once say about that high-speed rail thing, which I think was originally... I may be wrong about this. I heard it was originally conceived as like going from like San Francisco to Los Angeles or someplace, you know, that made sense, like in a real corridor, but they couldn't do that. So they wound up making it from like Bakersfield to Fresno or something. Yeah. And someone said it's like from where nobody lives to where nobody wants to go.
Yeah. Well, that's a little bit unfair to Bakersfield. Yeah,
I'm
Fresno.
Sure.
But you know, so that's a real issue. And I think one of the ways that the Democrats could help themselves is by showing that they actually are a party that can support, you know, building things once again. But again,
especially can I just add a footnote? Especially when we are now in a moment where to fight climate change and to deal with things like the housing crisis and other issues, we actually really need to build. We don't need to, the mindset of the progressives has been to block projects, you know, because they weren't good for the environment or they weren't, you know. But now if you're going to like have energy projects, say nuclear, you're going to need to build, you know, the power lines. You're going to need to do a lot of building that is actually pro-environment, not anti.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
No, that's right. So the people may be surprised by this, but the two states that are the biggest producers of alternative energy are Texas and Oklahoma. And they do this because they don't have the permitting constraints that California and New York have. And right now, the big problem is getting all that electricity from the middle of the country out to the West Coast. And it takes almost 10 years to permit a, you know, set of transmission lines that go across multiple jurisdictions. And so, you know, it's just an indication of the paralysis of the government at the present moment. All right. So that's important also, but I don't think that that, you know, since there's been such a focus actually on cultural issues, I don't think that that's at the center of, you know, contemporary populism. And then finally, you know, you had Bill Galston, our mutual friend Bill Galston, on talking about human nature. And his, you know, argument was that actually we shouldn't be surprised at the kind of nasty politics that's emerged, because that's what human beings are. And we managed to cover that over or suppress it, you know, for some period. But now we're back to, you know, the state of nature, you know, which is, you know, again, it's true, but it doesn't really explain why at this particular moment, you know, you get this sudden eruption of the bad side of human nature. I think you need other explanatory factors. So that's basically kind of an overview of some of the alternative explanations. I think as a social scientist, you'd want to do this much more rigorously. I'm not sure you could do this with ultimate rigor. So I would simply say that, you know, I think there's grave weaknesses in all of the other explanations that don't exist for the internet and social media. The internet is privatized in the late 90s. It becomes very popular, and social media really starts in about 2012, 13 with the rise of Facebook, Twitter, and so forth. And I think that that course, you know, Jonathan Haidt has pointed this out with regard to teenage depression and anxiety and suicide, you know, that started spiking up right around the time that social media was introduced. And, you know, that corresponds to the period where politics in our country, in Europe, in Asia, in other places, all of a sudden got much nastier. As people made the transition from legacy media that was controlled, you know, that there were actually elites that wouldn't be willing to say anything.
They were gatekeepers.
You know, yeah, they're gatekeepers.
Which has became on the internet, became a dirty word, gatekeeper.
No, absolutely.
But they did a lot of good in keeping the nuts at bay.
Yeah, I think, in fact, you do have to have a certain amount of elite control over information because, you know, you need credibility. And, you know, what we got instead was a world where anyone could say anything anytime about anything they wanted, and they could attract enormous audiences. And so that's the world, you know, we're now stuck in, where you can live in a complete fantasy alternative reality, and you'll find millions of other people living in that same world with you, and really no, you know, counterweight to say, well, actually, this is not this is not, you know, the real world.
So let's take a moment to talk about OneSkin. I am not exactly the greatest consumer of beauty products. I mean, when I was 19, somebody tried to sell me wrinkle cream and I just laughed in their face. And so I've been somewhat, low key about all that stuff most of my life. But I have to say that, you know, I'm getting older now and the skin gets drier and wrinklier and all those things happen. And so, you know, the nice people at OneSkin, here's the product, they make this beautiful, very silky, smooth moisturizer. And I do use moisturizer because you have to when you get to be my age. And this really, it just goes on incredibly smoothly. And it's got a very silky texture, but not greasy, which is very important to me. I really do not like greasy things. If something feels greasy, I wash it off right away. But this is, it just sinks right into your skin. It gives it a nice softness and a little bit of a glow. And it's very nice. I really like it. The core, apparently, is their patented OS1 peptide, which is the first ingredient proven to target senescent cells. That's dying cells. The root cause of wrinkles, crepiness, and loss of elasticity. All signs of skin aging. And these results have now been validated in 5 different clinical studies. It is certified as safe for sensitive skin, and OneSkin products are free from 1,500 different harsh or irritating ingredients. So dermatologists have tested it and given it their imprimatur. And so it gives you these lovely effects and you don't have to worry about breakouts or rashes or anything along those lines. At the helm of this iconic skincare brand is their founding all-women team of longevity scientists with PhDs in stem cell biology, skin regeneration, and tissue engineering. OneSkin has also just launched their limited edition holiday sets, including the Nightly Rewind gift set, which adds the perfect touch of luxury to your gift list. It's the ultimate upgrade to any nightly ritual. It features their best-selling face moisturizer, their brand new peptide lip mask, and a sculpting Gua Sha tool. Each element is designed to work together as your body enters its nightly repair mode, helping renew skin at the cellular level for a stronger, smoother, and more youthful looking complexion. For a limited time, try OneSkin for 15% off using code Mona Charon at oneskin.co/Mona Charon. After your purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them, and please support our show and tell them we sent you.
There are other things about, specifically about the internet that, and the nature of our political, situation right now that really have to be explained by the particular dynamics of social media. Rene D'Arresta wrote a book last year called Invisible Rulers that I think traces this.
I also had her on my podcast.
Yeah,
discussed that book.
She's very good at this. And,
yes.
You know, I know this, and I suspect you do too, having your own social media platform. If you just have a normal conversation, informative, you know, with some expert, you know, there'll be probably more educated people that will like it and, you know, appreciate it. But, you know, it won't be very dramatic. The moment you say something really edgy or, you know, hostile or mean or, you know, over the top, then all of a sudden your likes go up. And, you know, even if you don't start out wanting to promote that kind of content, you do want more you want more followers, you want more influence. You see your numbers go up and you say, oh, okay, I see. That's what you have to do in order to get attention on the internet. And so it's really the audience in many ways that drives the extremism that you see. The other thing that the internet has done is to put together, through their recommendation algorithms, disparate audiences that really shouldn't be connected by any kind of social logic. So, for example, there were a lot of yoga moms that ended up believe in some version of QAnon, this, you know, this really crazy mm-hmm. conspiracy theory. So why should a yoga mom be attracted to QAnon? Well, it turns out there was a yoga guru who was into QAnon and started recommending this to his yoga followers. And then a recommendation algorithm on a platform said, oh, okay, there's this connection that we can quantify between yoga and QAnon. And so it began recommending to other yoga followers that, you know, they follow this kind of conspiratorial content. And if they began to like that, they'd say, oh, and by the way, here's another conspiracy theory that maybe you haven't heard of yet. Maybe you'll like this one. And so it just creates, you know, these weird social interactions that are all done in the interest of the bottom line of the platform, not in the interest of American democracy or social health or, you know, anything of that sort.
So a few years back when we were still doing the Beg to Differ podcast, we had George Will on as guest. And this topic came up of the algorithms on social media and how they work. And George, you know, who I revere, you know, he's an amazing, amazing person, amazing writer. But he was still, I think, stuck in the 20th century view of like what the press is. And he viewed this as censorship. And he thought, you know, he said, you know, it's information and, you know, you can't try from the top down to control. And I was much more open to the idea that actually the algorithm is not speech. The algorithm yeah. is a technique, right, by these companies to boost certain content and push it out to listeners. It isn't as if somebody is trying to limit what people can see. It's just a matter of how much, these algorithms direct people's attention in a particular direction. And when they direct it in a really poisonous direction, that I think could be, tell me what you think. I think you could regulate that without violating the First Amendment. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that the First Amendment framework is really inadequate to deal with internet platforms.
Yeah.
Because it's not just, you know, we have more freedom of speech than we've ever had before in terms of all the stupid, crazy things that people can say and get some audience. The real scarce commodity is attention and
yes.
Focus. And we're bombarded with so much stuff. And the question is, what do you actually see and listen to? And that's where the platforms have a big self-interest in directing you to the things that will make you want to engage, you know, further and grab more of your attention. And I think the classical theories about freedom of speech just don't apply in this kind of a world. So yeah, I do think that it is legitimate to regulate not so much speech, but this attention economy. Mm-hmm. And make sure that, you know, you're not directed towards things that, you know, are unhealthy for you. The trouble is that in this country, I just don't think that's possible any longer because of the existing polarization. I think that after 2016, a lot of people blamed, you know, Facebook and Twitter for promoting Donald Trump. And so the Democrats began to gently try to use a lot of social pressure to push the platforms to start deplatforming, you know, the worst people. This got more critical, you know, with vaccine denialism and then with the election. This affected us here at Stanford because we had created a Stanford Internet Observatory after the 2020 election. And, you know, these were serious academic researchers that were looking. In fact, Renee DiResta was one
yes.
of the people in that research group. Her big interest had been vaccine denialism. And so, you know, they were doing serious academic research into how this kind of misinformation spreads. The moment that the Republicans took the House in the 2020 midterms. Jim Jordan was put in charge of a, I think the committee was called something.
2022, was it? 2020 was a presidential year.
Yeah, 2022 election. The Republicans took the House in 2022. So Jim Jordan runs a committee. I think its title is something to look at the weaponization of the internet, but he was actually the weapon. I mean,
yes,
he was going to use his committee. And so he subpoenaed like the students that had been hired as research assistants and Renee and, you know, other people associated with the Stanford Internet Observatory, and made them, testify claiming that this was censorship. I think Renee has demonstrated, I think, pretty convincingly that they weren't censoring. They were not directing the government to take down tweets. They were just providing information about, you know, things, you know, sources of misinformation. But I think as a result, you know, the university basically pulled back on this whole effort, and the Republicans
succeeded. They were intimidated.
Yeah, they were intimidated, and they succeeded in shutting down this whole effort. And I think that now you've had this big vibe shift on the part of the big, corporate leaders of the tech sector, who not only are caving into this kind of pressure, but some of them actually seem to believe in some version of, you know, MAGA, the MAGA narrative. And so now, you know, the possibility of actually trying to moderate content on the internet is, I think, not possible in this country any longer.
The bad faith here is so thick, you could cut it with a knife. I mean, they, Jim Jordan and company, and of course all of MAGA, went berserk over the idea that Stanford had an academic study of misinformation on the internet and how to counter it and so forth, and screamed censorship. And, Twitter, didn't publish the information about the Biden, you know, the Hunter Biden laptop,
yeah.
You know, for 24 hours. And then they, you know, but that was like the most severe curtailment of liberty that anybody had ever heard of. And of course, they are now in power. And what are they doing?
Right.
Their devotion to free speech is, has gone completely out the window, and they are doing everything possible to literally crack down on any criticism and take people off the air who even tell jokes that they don't like.
No, that's right. I think that in Europe, you still have a little bit more social consensus around, you know, the old kind of liberal policy of promoting, you know, better quality discourse. But that's being threatened too. You have the same political dynamic where you have these rising right-wing parties in Germany and France and in Britain that are also screaming censorship at any effort to moderate content on the internet. So it's a very disturbing trend, I think, across the democratic world.
So before getting to any possible ways of coping with this situation, assuming that you've rightly identified what the problem is, I'd like to have a little bit more of a conversation about the racism element, because you rightly say that members of minority groups voted for Trump as well. And so the idea that this is simply a revived sort of white supremacist movement is too simplistic. And while I definitely think that's right, I also think, though, that this MAGA movement has turned over rocks, and all of these creatures have crawled out from underneath. They have invited in from the very beginning, Trump said that anybody, no matter how vile, who supports him, he will not renounce. So remember in 2015, he was pressured very hard to denounce the KKK and say that didn't welcome his support, but he didn't want to do it. He said he'd never heard of David Duke. Which was, of course, you know, laughable. And that has been a consistent theme. And so I do want to say that what this did reveal is what this whole movement revealed is that those buried aspects of conservatism in America that were not evident to me coming up. You know, that the old kind of the white supremacy, the anti-Semitism, the isolationism, all of those things that characterized the right before World War II, that we thought were pretty much dead and gone.
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, relegated to the really, to the fever swamps. It turns out there was a lot more of it than, I'll speak for myself. There was a lot more of it than I realized. Mm-hmm. And Trump was able to, take the lid off. What do you make of that?
No, that's absolutely true. The other really big issue is the manosphere, you know, the
yes.
gender issue, which I do think is new simply because it's a reaction to hundreds of millions of women all over the world moving into the workplace, and occupying, a much more prominent, economic role in our contemporary information society. I actually wrote about this in my least read book. I wrote a book called The Great Disruption back in the late 1990s. And I argued that the reason for this increase in labor force participation by women was not ideological. It wasn't because of feminism as a doctrine. It really was driven by the nature of the economy, because we now live in an economy where the typical, you know, especially low-skill worker sits in front of a computer screen, doesn't lift yep. heavy objects off the factory floor. And women simply are better at that, especially mm-hmm. young women. They're more reliable. They don't take stupid risks. You know, they are less likely to be drug addicted, you know, so on and so forth.
And it's more of a service economy, and women are better at interpersonal interaction
yeah,
than
yeah.
men.
So it's absolutely, you know, economically determined that women should have this more important place. And I think that means that especially at lower skill levels in working class families, they've been displacing men. Now, I also admit that the Democratic Party did not recognize this issue. And I think, you know, they based in the last election, they based their appeal, you know, heavily on a female voting base. You know, they wanted to make abortion the central issue. And I think for that reason, a lot of young men said, well, you know, what about me? They don't really have anything that is going to help me. But I think that's also something that has, you know, this kind of blatant misogyny has also come out in a very ugly way on the part of the, you know, the hard right and the MAGA right. And I think that's also something that was latently there, but is much more prominent because of these big socioeconomic shifts that we've been experiencing.
You know, there could have been a different way to go. I mean, you know, you could have imagined a world in which people joined together behind efforts like Richard Reeves and others, you know, to draw attention to the boy crisis and to try to, you know, help boys who are struggling in school and sort of navigate this new economy. And, you know, he has lots of suggestions about that. And, you know, we could have approached this in a very positive, helpful way. And instead, it's been used as a wedge issue. And it has, yes, it has invited unbelievably vicious misogyny, into, mainstream politics. You've got J.D. Vance, you know, who's saying things that belong with Andrew Tate and the real the truly criminal types out there who are unfortunately getting a big following. So, all right. So we now know it's the internet that has brought us to where we are. And the internet is obviously not going to go away. But to put this in sort of very broad historical context, new technologies have come along before that have been unbelievably disruptive. And we've sort of eventually gotten our arms around it. So, you know, the printing press famously led to 100 years of war between Protestants and Catholics. The radio was used by demagogues in the 1930s very successfully. So how do you see us coping with this new challenge, if you see a way out? Do you think there's a chance that we will figure out how to manage this new world of internet communication without all becoming QAnon believers?
Yeah, actually, you missed something because we've been talking for 40 minutes without mentioning the word AI.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And that's as if we didn't have enough troubles.
Yeah, and that's going to make things a lot worse in terms of credibility of sources and, you know, distrust in institutions and so forth. So I have certainly no solution for that problem. In 2020, I ran a Stanford working group on platform scale because what we decided was that the problem with these big internet platforms, there was an economic dimension to it that antitrust law was meant to address, but there was also a political dimension where large platforms could be used to gain political power. I felt that Silvio Berlusconi was the first person that had figured this out, and he bought a media empire in order to get elected a prime minister of Italy. Elon Musk figured this out. He bought Twitter not because it was a profitable venture, but he wanted political influence. And so I think that the central problem is to reduce the power of these big platforms that benefit from these huge economies of scale. Suggestion in this working group on platform scale was something we called middleware, where instead of the platform deciding where your attention would be directed, that you should have the knobs and dials where you could specify what it is and go through a third-party content moderator. So if you didn't want to hear all the garbage about, you know, conspiracy theories, you could find a middleware provider that would take all that stuff out of your feed. The typical objection to this was that this would increase the echo chambers and you'd only hear stuff that you wanted to hear. But I think that that's still
there already.
Yeah. I think that, you know, the worst problem is actually, you know, this ability of the big platforms to grab people's attention without their, you know, assenting to that, you know, to that move and reduce their power. And if you actually had a more decentralized way of moderating content, you could actually reduce the power of these platforms. So that was, you know, I still believe that this is a good idea. The trouble is that there isn't a business model that stands behind this that's, I think, really viable. And I think that's why it's not taken off. Short of that, I really, you know, it's very hard to see under our polarized politics right now a way forward where you could try to reinsert a little bit more elite control over what, you know, people saw on the internet.
But it isn't elite control. It would be individuals control because they would be choosing. They would say, I want to use this intermediary to keep the poison out of...
But it's related, though, because you could have individuals that, you know, will pick a middleware company that will certify information. There's actually a company, NewsGuard, that does that.
A friend of mine is affiliated with them.
Yeah. So if you actually want to have more credible information, you could actually pay this service, you know, some nominal fee to direct you to really credible information. I thought, an association of colleges and universities could create a middleware filter that they would require their students and faculty to use that would, strip out a lot of the really toxic, bad content and direct people to more credible sources of information.
Wouldn't it would have to be bipartisan. You'd have to get a whole bunch of Christian colleges involved too. And, you know, so that you got input from all different viewpoints, but that everybody would be united in wanting to eliminate the really, noxious, misinformation.
Yeah.
Right?
No,
they wouldn't limit ideas, but they would just limit misinformation.
I think that the one virtue of this middleware approach is that it is nonpartisan, that, you know, you could pick conservative voices. You only want to hear, you know, MAGA influencers. And if that's your choice, you know, you get to do that. So it doesn't obviously bias the political conversation in one direction or another. So politically, I think, you know, it's a way forward, but I think the problem is economic, that there's just not a business model that we came up with that would even make people pay a relatively small sum to have a middleware, you know, a provider, you know, direct their attention.
Well, this might be something for people who are, you know, concerned about the threats to democracy to be giving a lot more thought to and thinking ahead, because the political environment is changing. We're seeing that. We saw it last week, you know, with that enormous vote. So MAGA is losing steam. That may not continue, but if it does, then it will open up possibilities for reform. And it's, you know, arguably, during the Biden administration, we missed opportunities to make far-reaching reforms and prevent some of the problems that we're having now. We could have seen a move, for example, to limit the or change the Insurrection Act so that the president doesn't have so much unreviewable authority. We could have, I mean, you know, we could even propose constitutional amendments. Who knows? You know, that I would personally love to see the pardon power go away.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I think it's, yeah, that was a big mistake in the Constitution, a potentially devastating one. And we see that now. So one thing that I think would be helpful for people who are creative about this sort of thing and can think through the business side of it, as well as the constitutional aspects and whatnot, would be to start thinking now about potential reforms that, if freedom-loving people, democracy-loving people do get back into power in the next few years, that they can set about being really serious about fixing some of these, what we see as almost existential flaws in our system that are threatening the very health of our democracy.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, there's going to be opportunities down the road to really do serious reform. So, Mona, you're going to have to invite me back on your show at some point to talk about my Reform for Results group, because we actually agree with Elon Musk that the federal bureaucracy is not terribly efficient, except that we think that he went about reforming it in completely the wrong way. And actually, as a result of the ensuing destruction, you know, there may be an opportunity in coming years to actually do a serious reform of the public sector. And, you know, I think if Kamala Harris had been elected, you know, it would have been impossible. Things just would have been frozen, you know, in a status quo that isn't, you know, isn't all that great.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We will do that.
Okay.
Well, Frank, thank you so much for joining me.
All right. Thanks for having me.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right Rug.